You're listening to KTOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The seven personal stories you are about to hear were told on February 12, 2014 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was On the Road. Music was performed by Dan Olson.
Mark Stofa works as a fishmonger, whaleboat watch captain, and fishery biologist. He was raised in Bolivar, a tiny town in western New York State. Mark arrived in Juneau nearly 20 years ago by way of Fairbanks, Dillingham, Sandpoint, Chignik, and Kodiak. He enjoys living off the land, hunting, trapping, fishing, berry picking, and wood cutting. Please welcome to the stage, Mark.
This story is a story about a 20-year road trip from hell and back, really. It was told to me in a remote village in Sierra Leone where I served in the Peace Corps 25 years ago on a recent visit I made there in May by my friend Francis Camara. So the story, about 22 years ago, he said we knew the war was moving our way in Sierra Leone and even to our remote village, which sits in the bottom of this bowl surrounded by hills of beautiful West Africa rainforest. He said, we heard gunfire one day and I gathered the family up and we went up onto the ridge to wait to see what would happen, but the rebels didn't come that day. So we went back to the house and we slept with one eye open that night. The next day, we heard gunfire again and we went up the hill and waited, and this time the rebels did come. Some of the people in the village tried to return that night and sneak back and get some of their belongings, and they wished they never had. Some were taken out behind the school and shot. Others were given the choice of a long sleeve or a short sleeve. A long sleeve was where they would hack off your arm at the wrist. A short sleeve was at the elbow. Francis said, we were up on that hilltop for a few days waiting to see what would happen, and we realized that the rebels were now coming out into the bush looking for us. This was the RUF, the group that was supposedly there to overthrow the government for the people of Sierra Leone, really all they ever did was wage war on innocent civilians. They really didn't fight in any battles against anybody. So when they saw they were coming up for them, they headed west or east towards Guinea, and they said when the rebels got there, they went west, and he said, just by the grace of God, they went the wrong way or they'd have captured us. Francis said we had to leave everything there, just what we could carry, and he had 49 of his family members with him, and they made their way towards Guinea and came to a town with their tribesmen out of the Kono tribe further towards the river between the two countries, and he said that they took them in, housed them, and they ended up staying there sort of trying to wait out the war for 3 years, farming and just getting by. And eventually the war reached them there and they had to go across the river into Guinea. The rebels even followed them across the river into Guinea, and one night Francis said one of the notorious leaders of the RUF, a guy named Mosquito, came to Francis and said, Francis, why don't you come back with us and we'll protect you. We'll take care of you. And Francis knew what that meant. So he said, that sounds good. I'll see you here in the morning and we'll go. So that night he gathered his family again and they left everything there and took off further into Guinea to get away from the rebels. The next site they came to, they were in a village there that they ended up staying for 4 years. The villagers helped farm, house them there, and it was one of the most poignant things Francis sort of said to me over the 5 days he told me this story when we were making fence one day around his farm. He said, Mark, we didn't struggle when we were in Guinea, and I realized when I saw him when he was telling me that, just really what a man he was. All he needs is a machete to live. He can take that out and cut the bush down and make a farm. He can split vines to make rope to make a basket or a fish trap, and he can make rope to catch animals with a trap in the bush, anything you need, a shelter. You know, we'll wet our pants here if the power goes out for an hour or we lose internet service for 10 minutes, you know. And I really just saw over the 25 years, I'd really lost a lot of my self-reliance where he never lost his. As the war finally started to come to a close and it looked like there might be peace, they made their way down through Guinea to Conakry, the capital, and then probably took the only boat ride they ever took down the coast to Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, and they made their way back up country to Kono, their homeland. But when they got back, the finishing touch these rebels would do is after they would clean out a village and kill people and maim people and pillage everything they could, they'd burn it to the ground. So Francis, they had no village to go back to. He had no place to stay. And he said, and most importantly, that the school was gone. And that was one of the most important things to him, was to be able to have that school there so his kids could go to school, because he wasn't able to. He had to sort of take over the family when his dad died when he was young. So they lived in Koidu, the capital city of the province, for 10 years. And he said he was really proud of his wives. They learned to do market business and trade there and make some money to help feed and clothe the family. And he did some farming around the edges of the city. And he said he even tried to do diamond mining, but he said he'd never do that again. He'd stick to farming because he got swindled, and he said, you can't eat diamonds. And so I went over there, Sarah helped me. We went up garage sale looking for sandals or pocket knives, anything I could think to take over there as gifts, and they were really grateful for those. But the biggest gift that I ended up taking, I really didn't even know, was this picture I'd had printed off of all my fish farmers that were there when I was there, so I could go to the villages I worked at to say, is this Pa here? Is he there? And people held on to that picture with a death grip, like they were looking in a time machine, like it was 24 karat gold. And myself and other Peace Corps volunteers now have realized that we're sort of the reservoir of pictures from that time, because all the pictures of that time are gone from before the war, because they were all destroyed. So myself, I put together a photo album with all the pictures I had of my neighbors there, and we're going to send those back this spring. The village is on its way to rebuilding. It was Francis's second year of being back in his village now, farming, and he's building a house now, and things are looking up for them. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Christy Chambor. Christy has had someone else compose her bio. Here it is. A native of Long Island, Christy escaped the East Coast to live out her destiny in Juneau. This includes, but is not limited to, boy meets girl, girl becomes wife, wife becomes mom, mom becomes dog mom, all in the rainforest. With all of this going on, she manages to stay sane by belting out Broadway tunes wherever she goes. Here's Christy.
Thank you. I became enchanted with Juneau in the summer of 2005. I kind of on a whim gave up my rent control department in New York City and came to work seasonally in Juneau and live in Clint Farr's basement in a room affectionately known as the Den of Sin. We won't go there. Anyway, fell in love with it, and I was here for 4 days, and my boyfriend at the time proposed while we were snowshoeing on Perseverance Trail and made it even more magical. And at the end of the summer, I had to head back home to Baltimore, but there was a wedding to plan, and it was Juneau or Jamaica, and Juneau won. So we flew back up here for a destination wedding in 2006 at Point Louisa, and it was 80 degrees and sunny, and Clint married us, and there were birds and, you know, salmon jumping, and anyway, it was beautiful and fabulous, and once again, the lure of Juneau beckoned, and we headed back to a very hot and humid summer in Baltimore to find out 3 weeks later we were pregnant. With a baby that Scott's parents believe was conceived on our wedding night, and my mom very slyly told me she knows it wasn't. But the one thing we both agreed on, and the one thing that we were both very passionate about, was that we didn't want to raise our baby in Baltimore. We wanted to have a family and live in Juneau, and we're like, so how do we make that happen? And we start making all these plans and phone calls and leaning on the friends that we had made here, and just anything you hear of, let us know. And months are going by, and finally I give birth to Kai on March 22nd, and March 24th my phone rings, and it's a job for me in Juneau. And I'm having a phone interview 3 days after giving birth. And 5 weeks later, they buy me an airline ticket and my family tickets. And we're here meeting employers. And Allie McKenna happens to have a fabulous little apartment on Barron's. And she thinks my baby's cute, so we can rent it. And we have a house. And it's all working out beautifully. And then we get back to Baltimore, and we're trying to plan and pack, and I realize I have amassed 3 baby showers worth of baby crap. I've got a tire minivan full of baby stuff, and so this road trip that we had planned as a family was now going to be a man trip for my husband Scott, while me and the baby flew up here to reside in the Juneau Hotel until the apartment was ready. So it all started really good. You know, we got dropped off at the airport, we headed here, Denise picked us up, and we went to Eagle Beach and did all these fun things. But Kai was not a sleeper. So I had a baby and trying to get stuff organized here and no sleep. And I'm also getting ready to start a new job and doing that as a new mother, and all these things are kind of going on in my head. But Scott and I are corresponding every day about this trip. So we have an email a day and a phone call every night, and his trip's amazing. I mean, he's having a good time. He's meeting people in coffee shops and amazing sunsets and, oh, you won't believe what I've seen. And, you know, and then I get this one cryptic email in the middle of all this, which is, hey, car's feeling a little heavy, so I stopped at the post office in the dump somewhere in the Midwest. We'll talk about it later. Okay. It's fine. So it's kind of going on, and I have to start work. And now I am a full-time working mother who's not sleeping, and Scott's still on this great road trip, and I'm starting to feel something that I literally haven't felt in like 12 weeks of being a new mom, which is anger. And I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to feel about it. I'm just kind of confused. I'm like, I have a beautiful baby. I'm finally in Juneau. I'm, you know, Allie called me and I can move into my place. Everything's working out, but I still can't fully get there. I'm just not feeling it. And, you know, we're coming up close to a day where I didn't have a babysitter for Kai, and Scott was sort of at the end of his trip. I was like, you just have to be back by Friday. That's it. The ferry ticket from Skagway, just make sure you're in Juneau on Friday. So Wednesday, when I get the ferry confirmation by email for Saturday, with a note that says, I found a great cabin and there's some wonderful hiking, I'll see you on Saturday, I didn't even know what to do. I didn't even know how to feel until the phone rang and he's like, hey, did you get my ferry confirmation? And the conversation went just like this. Yes. And if you are not in Juneau by Friday, don't come. Click. And I felt wretched and terrible. But then lo and behold, when I saw a very tall, bald man knocking on the window at the apartment on Friday night, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And the baby was sleeping. And I was like, we can unload the car. We can just start getting settled, because everything's been feeling so unsettled to get here. And I just wanted to be home. And so we unload the car, and I'm looking around at the stuff, and I'm like, where's my diaper genie? And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, where's the diaper genie? And he's like, I don't even know what that is. And I'm like, you're answering my questions with questions, which tells me you know what I'm talking about. Where's the diaper genie? And there's still no answer. Now he's angry, and now he's storming off, and he's saying things like, that diaper genie represents everything that's wrong with parenting today. Why? Why can't you just throw diapers in the garbage? And oh my God, a huge screaming blowout fight. I'm crying. He's yelling. The baby wakes up. now he's up, and we're going through this whole cycle of not sleeping and trying to tag team and change diapers, and then I have to start my day. And lo and behold, about 7 o'clock that morning, there's a knock at my door, and it's Allie from upstairs. And I haven't even given a thought to what they may or may not have heard or what they might be thinking as we're their new tenants, and who knows. And I open the door, and she hands me a cup of coffee, says, "You're going to need this," gives me a little squeeze on the arm, and says, "If you need us to take the baby later so you can get some sleep, just bring him upstairs. Have a good day." And then walked off to work. And I knew right then and there we were going to be okay. Thank you.
Our next speaker tonight is Sarah Hannon. Sarah is a lifelong traveler and always enjoys a road trip. She teaches at JDHS and spends lots of time laughing at her life. She told her first mudroom story last year under the theme First Times. She had such a delightful time that she decided to continue telling stories from the life of her adventures with Mark Stofa. Please welcome Sarah.
So first of all, we were not supposed to both tell stories tonight. And when I signed up for the story, it's not supposed to be about Mark Stofa. But as all storytellers know, stories have lives of their own. And the first time I mentioned out loud that I'd signed up to tell a story to the theme On the Road, where I had a completely different story in mind, our friend Jeff Campbell was in the car with us and said, "You mean you're going to tell a list of all the things that Mark picks up on the road?" And anyone who knows Mark, now you guys who didn't know him, who met him tonight, think of him as this serious, perhaps intellectual, do-gooder. But anyone who knows Mark knows he's really kind of a raven scavenger trickster and spends a lot of time picking things up on the road, which, you know, that includes useful things like boat cushions and life vests and coolers and totes and boat rollers for trailers, which if you live in Juneau long enough, you have a rusty old trailer and it regularly loses the rollers, but so does about 200 other people because they're always on the road. And when you need one, there's one. And Mark has usually scoped it out when he's decided that everybody should help with the adventure to pick up the object from the roadside. But he doesn't always tell you about it until he starts screaming commands at you to pull over or slow down or back up. And that's if you're the driver, and you don't really realize till it's happening that he's going to open the door and reach out rodeo style and grab this object and throw it in and tell you to go, 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 it's okay. And you're kind of freaked out. And the first time it happens, people do get kind of freaked out, but most of our friends at some point have benefited from something he's found on the road, you know, that is trash. Kurt happened to pick up a wallet that had money in it and no ID. That was the best score. Sometimes you're the passenger and you don't know it, but he just suddenly veers over to the side and yells commands at you like he's coaching basketball. Stick and roll, stick and roll. And you know that he means pick and roll, but okay, you jump out, you grab it, and you don't know what it is. And sometimes, again, it's a useful object. Sometimes it's not. But when you're in the car with Mark, you become aware of one of his true talents, which is short communicative phrases or one-liners. And Mark's life, although when he's telling a serious story, seems much more literate than that, but the reality is he frequently communicates with repetitive one-liners, and if they are one that he uses all the time, they are followed up with, "It's funny every time." And some of them are obnoxious. And one of our nieces, who's now a full-grown adult, but she was 4 or 5 at the time, and with her 4 or 5-year-old face, looked up at Uncle Mark, and she has these big blue eyes and golden locks, and she says with all seriousness, "Are you still going to be like this when I get older?" And we all had to drop and, you know, cough back down the milk, because we realized not only was he going to be like this, the one-liners were going to be the exact same one. And they were going to be as obnoxious, and you'd know them. Now, riding in cars with Mark all over the world, you encounter these one-liners. So we find ourselves in West Africa, in Mali, in the back of a Land Rover on the way to Djenné, which is the ancient trading partner of the city of Timbuktu. Timbuktu lays in the north of Mali at the apex of the Niger River before it turns south, and Djenné lives in the floodplain between the Niger and Bané rivers. And in the final piece of the road trip to get there, you are going to do a classic dry little ferry ride, but it's really just a barge that the cars have driven on, and then it's going to get pulled across the river, and on the other side the cars unload. And there's a group of women traders who are making handicrafts who figured out this is the perfect place to sell their wares because there's a captive market for the time that the boats fill up, because you never get out of line no matter how long it's going to take, whether it's 30 minutes or an hour before the ferry fills up. You're going to sit there, and then you're going to have the time across the river, and they've got a captive market. So they start hitting up all the cars and coming around, and we have happened that day to be in a car without our people, without our fixer, and without any local money. And it was a classic Mark thing where Mark has arrived back at the compound we're staying at, and we have another niece who's grown up with us, and he says, gotta get in the car, gotta get in the car, we're going to Djenné, we're going to Djenné. And we've been trying to figure out how to do the side trip for several days, and suddenly the opportunity arose. So we're in this car with people we don't know who don't speak English. Our fixer's not there. We don't have any local currency. And these vendors are saying to us, you know, these ladies are trying their best, as all vendors in third world countries know, 10 polite phrases in 10 different languages. So they're trying in English and French and German to sell us their wares. And they settle on English, and they keep saying to us, we have really good price, we have really good price, we have really pretty things, really pretty things. And it's not a matter of they don't have a really good price and they don't have really good pretty things. We have no local currency. And Mark eventually is encountering these women and saying, you know, he's trying some Creole and stuff, but he does a classic Mark when they will not relent, and the windows are open, and it's 110 degrees out, and you can't roll up the window, but they won't go away. And so he turns to them and he says, do you got really bad price? Because I want a really bad price. And they're perplexed, and so they turn to each other, and they all confer, and they try and get it translated, and they come back around, and they say, we have really pretty things, red and blue and green, really pretty things, red, blue, and green. He goes, do you have magenta and fuchsia? Because I'm kind of a pink guy. And again, they turn around and they are trying to translate this because they know if they can just come up with whatever magenta and pink are, they are sure to make a sale. We come away from the trip with Denise, who some point later says, you know, I didn't used to get Uncle Mark, but now I get it. And what you're guaranteed on a road trip with Mark is something to come away with it, whether it's a one-liner or a useful piece of trash that you found on the road.
Our next speaker is Travis Smith. Travis is a 26-year resident of Juneau. He moved here when he was six. Now you know how old he is. After a brief stays in Montana, Wyoming, and Wisconsin, he is the owner of the Rookery Cafe and a believer in the power of espresso. When he's not busy working on his empire, he likes to play in the snow, read, drink single malt whiskey, and has recently taken up poetry. No, pottery? Pottery. He has survived nearly 20 years of driving. You might not believe that after the story you're about to hear. Here's Travis.
I wish it had been poetry. This might go a little smoother. So I was 10 when I was sent to Montana to stay with my grandparents for the summer, and it was there that I lost my driving virginity to a John Deere lawn tractor. I mowed the grass as often as they would let me, which wasn't that often because it didn't really grow that fast. But by the time I left, I was pretty sure that I was going to be able to drive anything I got my hands on. That December, Christmas time, I got to go to Texas, and I shot my first shotgun and drove a truck, and that was a pretty good day for a 10-year-old. But it would be 4 long years of Sega hard-driving video games before I got my hands on a real car wheel. My mother might have wished it was longer. So my birthday is in late October, which means as soon as you're 14 in Juneau, you can get a driver's permit, which means I wanted to drive, which meant she had to decide whether it was going to be better for her to let me learn to drive in the winter or to listen to me complain about the fact that I wasn't driving, even though I was old enough to drive, until spring had rolled around. So 2 years of winter driving, one out. I don't know how I convinced her to let me take the car and spin Brody's, but it was something to the extent of, you don't know how to get out of an uncontrolled spin unless you're in one for practice. So there we were in the parking lot off of Rotary Park, the car going in reverse pretty fast when the front end swung around and illuminated a passing police car. And I'm thinking, it's over. It's just, this is game over. But the car didn't stop, and our car came to a stop. And I don't know, it was sometime later when, again, this decision about the uncontrolled car and the practice, and she let me spin Brody's again with her in the car, but we almost hit a light pole in a parking lot behind the Safeway shopping center in the dead of night in the winter. And it was at that time that I swore I would never do anything like this again, and everything was going to be fine. Maybe if the cop had come and said something, none of the rest of this story would have happened. So October 26th, 2016, at 3:45 p.m. I mean, 1996, that's what I'm going at. 1996, sorry. I get a warm, laminated State of Alaska driver's license. At 4:12, I drop my mother off in the driveway and leave in her car to go to a friend's house and pick them up. And about 4 minutes later, as we're peeling out of the driveway in reverse, spraying gravel and spinning the car around just like I'd learned on the ice all those years back, narrowly avoiding walkers and passerbys and rocks and trees, that was the beginning of my driving power and the move that I would use to pretty much terrify or impress anybody who was in my car for the next couple of years. It was about 4 days later when I ran into a shopping cart corral in Fred Meyer's and knocked it over onto another car and sped away. I'm sorry if that was your car. A couple days after that, I backed into a Ford Explorer after dropping off a prospective girlfriend at her house. Her dad had just gotten it back that day because she had totaled it a month before. So that relationship just went nowhere. So here's this big dent in my car, and the insurance money is en route, which was great because a couple weeks later, when I was out driving one night, I found this cool spot behind Mendenhall River School where you could just drive in laps like it was a racetrack around the middle of the parking lot, and you could just get this drift, and the car was spinning real good. And so the next day, I'm like, I got to show my friends this, and we go to the parking lot, and I'm like, guys, check this out, and I hit the parking lot faster and icier, and it was the explanation of trying to convince my mom that I had done this somehow on a real road, that's why the wheel looks like this. I just hit the curb. Then what we left out of the story was the 45 miles an hour in a parking lot part of the story. I don't think she ever really believed my story, but for whatever reason, she let it pass. So the car's broken. It's out of commission for just long enough for me to forget that driving fast is not a good idea. And when I got the car back, by the way, it was paid for because of the money I got from backing into the Explorer. Didn't fix the dent, fixed the broken wheel. Enter Super Bowl, whatever, 1997. We're watching the game at one friend's house because he has the big TV. But the really important thing was the MTV halftime special, which they didn't have MTV. So we decided we were going to drive as fast as we could to the nearest house that had MTV, which was only four blocks away in the middle of the valley. We're going from not very far, four blocks away. And it was a beautiful, icy, cold, snowy day. There was snow falling, and all I can imagine is this snow globe view that this really nice woman had as she looked out of her window into the yard. And it was so ruined when my car came crashing through her yard and took out the mailboxes and sent them flying into a power pole and totaled my car. We didn't see the halftime special. I did watch the rest of the Super Bowl, and I honestly couldn't tell you who won. didn't really matter. I'm like, my life is over. I'm never going to drive again. And I went home, and I didn't even tell my mom. She was like, why is your driver's license on the table? I'm like, well, let me show you, because I'm pretty sure you're going to take it away now. And she did, which was smart. So I had about a three-month break from driving my car, and I finally got it back, and I'm really excited to have a car again, and you can drive so fast in a car, and I just almost totaled again, like, the day I got the car back. I hit a patch of gravel in the middle of the valley, in the residentials, and just went into a ditch, it was like, that was the light bulb moment where I was like, you can't drive like this. You just can't drive like this and live. So that's it. Yeah, I've got three seats if anybody needs a ride.
Listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling events on KTOO News Juno. These stories were recorded on February 12, 2014 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was On the Road. Curious? Visit www.mudrooms.org.
Our next speaker tonight is Eric Caldwell. Eric lived in Juneau from kindergarten to the end of high school, at which time he left Alaska permanently. 10 years later, he woke up, owning a house in Douglas, wondering how in the world this could have happened. In the dozen years since his return, Eric has been the founding producer of 24-Hour Miracle, Morally Impoverished, the Alaska Playwright Project, and the Alaska State Improv Festival. Next week, he will be performing at the Seattle Festival of Improv Theater, where he will be the first Alaskan to perform at a Lower 48 festival as part of an invited ensemble. When he's not producing, performing, or working for the government to support his art habit, he can often be found spending time at home with his wife, Sarah, son, Miles, and their main coon cat, Thomasina. He can correct me when he comes up here. Eric!
It was June 1992. My mom made a very simple request. Since you're going to be in the area, why don't you stop in on your Auntie Pat? In the area meant within 200 miles, through a barren wasteland that would be of no account to humanity except for the Bakken Shale Foundation, the Bakken Shale Formation, and its flammable rocks. A place aptly known as Devil's Lake. Let's set the scene a little bit. Imagine you're in Fargo. If you've never been to Fargo, you have your impressions of what you think it's like. Go with that. Drive an hour and a half north of Fargo on the interstate, take a left onto Highway 2, play Spot the Nuclear Missile Silo, or maybe even Spot November 33, the Nuclear Missile Launch Facility. You know, the place where the United States Armed Forces were deciding second by second whether or not life as we know it was going to continue. Keep driving from there for about 2 hours. Until the monotony gets to you to the point where you want to claw your eyeballs out. Right past that is Devil's Lake. So my directions were easy enough. Look for the mile marker. Look for the farmhouse with rusted out Edsels parked out front. Then left, right, left onto the back dirt roads and boom, you're right there at Pat's. So sure, easy to find. I pull up. I'm met at the door by a gentleman who I had no idea there was even supposed to be anybody else here. And he says, oh, well, Pat's not here. And he offers me a drink. Right about then is when the world stood still. Inane chatter, horse flies, still air. Nothing happens. Oh, I'm sure that Pat's going to be back in a couple of minutes. I try to make my excuses, say I've got to get on the road. No. You know, she'll feel horrible if she misses you. My crystal light has magically refilled. I'm becoming hypnotized by the ceiling fan. I have identified the flooring as a classic Armstrong pattern, and I am trying to figure out which decade it was manufactured in. Oh, she'll be back real soon. Finally, I can't take any more of the conversation. I can't take any more of the crystal light. I get in the car. I leave. Quick turns, right, left, right, and I'm back to the highway. Yeah, that's not the highway. It is a labyrinth of endless paved dirt, plowed dirt, looking all the same. I just follow it as best as I can. I'm turning, I'm moving, and, you know, every now and then you see one of these county road signs, but it never tells you which direction. It's mocking me, and it's mocking Rand McNally, who's never heard of this road either. Finally, I come to a four-way stop, and I take left. I'm zigging around. There's a curve here. There's a bend there. I want to go straight. I can't. With every single turn, I'm feeling more and more disoriented, like a blindfolded man being knocked around in the back of a cargo van. And, you know, turn, bend, turn, curve. Wow. It's the four-way stop sign I've left behind a half an hour ago. As afternoon keeps on, I see the gauge getting closer and closer to empty. I keep going. There's nothing else to do. But I'm losing my mind. I'm becoming delusional. I start thinking about every book I've read on the Bermuda Triangle, every episode of The Twilight Zone, Brigadoon. Have I become Prometheus behind the wheel? You know, that's just crazy. And it's that four-way stop again. Okay, this time I'm going straight. I don't care how far out of my way it's taken me. I am not going to make the same mistake three times in a row. So I go straight. And this time the road cooperates. It lets me go straight. Straight into the bowels of hell. And I keep driving. About 4 hours after I started this quest to see Auntie Pat, I finally find civilization. Well, it's a bar. What passes for a bar in this part of North Dakota? It's more like a double-wide trailer with a cooler in the back. You know, the kind of place you saddle up to the bar and you ask the bartender what they got, and she says, "Oh, we got both kinds, Bud and Bud Light." So instead, I saddle up to the bar and I say, "Where is the nearest paved road?" "Oh, where are you going to, hon?" "Right now, Devil's Lake." "Oh, well, the easiest way to get to Devil's Lake..." No. "Nearest paved road." Sensing that I was quite possibly insane and that I was obviously buying neither a Bud nor a Bud Light, she pointed me in the direction of the nearest paved road. I got there, and there was this beautiful sign. It said Devil's Lake. It had an arrow. It had the number of miles. And when it told you what highway you were on, it even said north. So finally, I get to Devil's Lake. For those of you who haven't been, it was more or less a collection of strip malls, car dealerships, and most importantly, a gas station. I fill up, And yeah, it's civilization of a sort, but I really don't trust North Dakota now. So I stick to the paved roads, and I plowed my way into Saskatchewan. I never left those paved roads in North Dakota again. I've still never met Auntie Pat. Thank you.
Originally from Southern California, our next speaker, Pamela Garcia, has now lived in Juneau for 33 years. She arrived in Juneau on Alaska Day, appropriately enough, right off the ferry when the ferries docked downtown. She and her first husband, Brad, started living at the Alaskan Hotel and graduated to North Douglas, living in a variety of situations as were possible still back then, squat cabin, Airstream trailer on the side of the road, and a float house. Still available today. After saving lots of tips from waitressing at the Fiddlehead, she now lives in a regular house on North Douglas with her second husband, Steve. Here's Pam.
Okay, it was 1981. I was a 19-year-old Southern California chica who had just moved up to the mountains, Mammoth Lakes, California. After a few weeks of being there, I walked into a health food store to buy myself a tube of Tom's toothpaste, and that's where I met Brad. Well, we hit it off right away, and after a month of good times, he pops the question. That question I thought I'd never hear. You want to go up to Alaska with me? As soon as I sell my Willie's truck, I'm heading up north to see my friends. Sure, that sounds cool. So I called all my friends and family. I'm going up to Alaska. And they all asked, are you going to go live in an igloo? I had no idea. After a few weeks, I take Brad down to Long Beach to visit my mom. After a few days of gathering my things and visiting, we were ready to go. Okay, Mom, we're going to go to Alaska. I'll call you in a few weeks once we get there. Okay, mija, cuidado. Don't worry, Mom, we'll be careful. Bye. So we head back up to Mammoth to drop off the Willies, and then we get a ride share to Seattle. Once we're in Seattle, we go to a used car lot to find the perfect Alaska mobile. We find it, a 1969 Buick Special. When the salesman found out we're going to take that up the Alaskan highway, he threw in a couple snow tires for insurance. $400 later, we are ready to go north to Alaska. So a week of driving through Canada, we just have the best time. So many beautiful sights. At night, we just pull off dirt roads and we either pitch a tent or sleep under the stars. But after about a week, we get to the Alaska-Canada border, Beaver Creek. So as we pull up to the border, Brad pulls out his wallet to get his ID out. And I can't find my wallet. Oh, no. I look all over the car. I cannot find my wallet. That didn't sit too well with the Border Patrol. So they take us in for questioning. They look at Brad. Where'd you pick this girl up hitchhiking? I didn't pick her up hitchhiking. She's my girlfriend, Pam Garcia. We've been traveling together since California. Well, they interrogate me. They make me take off my socks and shoes. After a while, they're convinced I am Pam Garcia, and so they let us go. So we head to the car, but then they notice the bag of green herbs on the dashboard and a roach clip. So they take that in for testing. Brad and I roll our eyes. Uh-oh, what's going to happen now? Well, they come back after about 5 or 10 minutes, and everything came out clean because the bag of herbs, I was actually for my asthma, and the roach clip, I was using for beadwork or something. So, phew! So, amazing enough, they let me through the border even though I didn't have any ID. So, next stop, Homer, to go see Brad's friends. When we get to Homer, Brad decides that, well, maybe I'll pick up some carpentry work, make some extra money for the next leg of our adventure. So he goes and talks to a contractor. Yeah, Brad Cure. Brad Cure, do you have a girlfriend named Pam Garcia? Yeah. How do you know? Well, the state troopers are looking for her. It's all over the radio. what? So we immediately go to the state troopers. What is going on? Well, apparently my twin sister had called and reported that I was missing. What? My heart sank to my stomach. This feeling of guilt ran over me because I hadn't even called home. I'd been gone for a couple weeks. So those were the days before cell phones and internet. So I go by a calling card. We find the first payphone, and I call home. Mom, yes, yes, it's me. I'm fine. I just got to Homer. Yes, I'm fine. She, poor mom, she was so worried. Apparently, some man had found my wallet on the side of the road, had called my mom, and she hadn't heard from me in weeks. Imagine your 19-year-old daughter takes off to Alaska with some guy she'd only known for a couple of months in a $400 car. So she had been worried to death. I felt horrible. So I assured her I was fine. I promised I'd call more often. So the following week, everybody's getting antsy. We're ready to go explore other parts of Alaska. So Brad and Brian pull out an Alaska map and decide, let's go to Eagle. It's at the end of the road on the Yukon River. Sure. So all four of us pile into that Buick special. We drive to Tok Junction, and from there we go to the Taylor Highway, past Chicken, and to Eagle. Population around 100 people. So it was awesome. It was spring breakup, and we got to see the magnificent Yukon River. Big slabs of ice creaking and groaning. It was just amazing to see this frozen river transform before our very eyes into a flowing body of water. It was awesome. And we put our teepee up, and I learned how to keep a fire going inside of it. Not too hot, not too smoky. I learned how to make bannock bread. I shot my first rifle. It was bear country. And I learned how to make birch bark baskets with an Athabascan woman. We even had porcupine with some locals. Didn't taste too great, but hey, you got to try everything once, right? I even later on in the season went dredging for gold up the Yukon. I had so many great experiences, but I also had the worst experience. That heartbreaking phone call to Mom. I had worried her so much, but even though it was really hard, it was also heartwarming to know that I was so well-loved. And even though I had separated from my family thousands of miles, that really we were all so connected. And it just took a second with a thought or a feeling, or better yet, a phone call. We were always connected.
So our next speaker is Tom Cosgrove, who's also on our storyboard. And last November, Tom and Pat McClear, who was one of our speakers last month, presented an evening of stories called Coming Out, Stories of Action and Reaction. It was a powerful and humorous evening with a standing room only audience. So here's Tom's bio. A few years back, Tom transitioned from a closeted writer to an emerging storyteller. He believes in the power of stories to inspire, enlighten, and inform. And being involved in Mudrooms has allowed him to put these beliefs into action. Tom escaped the city over 20 years ago and is damn glad he did. He now lives downtown on the flats with his spouse, two teenage children, and a rock star dog named Martin. Everybody ends with their dogs named whatever. It's just pointing that out.
I was hitchhiking south on I-35 just outside of Des Moines. I was heading back to Kansas City after a weekend rendezvous. I was in my early 20s, a college graduate, mostly unemployed, and once again crashing at my parents' house. The weather that day was typical March, windy and raw, and the sky was threatening. I'd been standing by the side of the road for almost 2 hours with nothing around me but corn. But I had seen enough cars to be able to spot them on the horizon, and I could tell the one that was approaching was moving much faster than the speed limit. I stuck out my thumb and put on my high-wattage smile. They must not have seen me, because they were past before they slammed on the brakes. The car came to a screeching halt in a cloud of gravel and dust. It was a 15-year-old brown Pontiac station wagon with fake wood siding. I ran up to the passenger side door. Inside the car, in the front bench seat, were two people. The passenger was a large white woman in a drab tent dress. She was munching on a bag of pork rinds. The driver was a very slight black man, at least 20 years her senior. He wore a snappy fedora and carried a toothpick in the side of his mouth. They were both waving at me to get in the car. I opened up the back passenger door. Where are you folks heading? Kansas City? Oh, perfect. One ride all the way home. Now, sure, they were a bit odd looking, but, you know, not physically threatening. So I tossed my backpack into the back of the car and slammed the door. The woman looked at me, smiled, turned to the driver, and said, "Let's go." And with no further conversation, we took off. Like a shot. That old guy must have had the pedal to the floor because that V8 engine whined like it was in agony. And as we accelerated, the car started to rattle and shake. Bald tires, loose lug nuts, and rusty parts were all vibrating at different frequencies. The noise was deafening. Conversation was impossible. Now, this was the era of Drive 55, but I watched that speedometer as it went past 60, 65, 70. The whine of the engine continued to increase in pitch. It felt like the wagon was going to shake apart. And then, between 75 and 80 miles per hour, quiet. All the noise and vibration stopped. All those competing motions had come into sync. It was peaceful. Now, we cruised along like this for a while, but even in rural Iowa, if you travel 25 to 30 miles per hour over the speed limit, you're going to overtake fellow travelers. The old guy's eyesight must have been really poor because he gave no indication that we were coming up on a semi. The gap between us continued to close until the only thing that I could see was mud flaps and a bumper. I braced for an impact. Moments before a collision, she turned, swatted the driver on the shoulder. He swerved out around that truck with inches to spare. Now, my heart rate had not even dropped when she yelled out, "Hitchhiker!" He stood on the brakes. We decelerated through that rattle zone and came to a smoke-filled stop. Now, a wise man probably would have gotten out of the car at that moment. But at the time, all I could think about was another 2 hours out in that cold wind. It kept me in the car. A guy opened the door. He had a bit of red hair peeking out beneath a Navy watch cap, and I could tell that he shopped at Navy surplus stores because we were sporting the same style. The woman yelled out, "We're going to KC. You want to join us?" He sized up the passenger, the driver, and me. He looked really uncertain. But he got in the car. I turned to him and waved, "Hang on." The driver hit the gas. We merged onto the highway and started the acceleration process. The new guy, he didn't handle it very well. I mean, he was really jumpy. But to his credit, once we had kind of achieved the harmonic convergence, he settled right down. Until we came up on another car. "Holy hell! Slow down! You're going to hit something!" Well, she tried to calm him down, but there was no way. And so she turned, swatted the driver on the shoulder, and we dropped back to a speed that left us in the rattle zone. The new guy's alarm was kind of a wake-up call to me. I mean, it made it clear to me that this ride was not worth the risk to life and limb. I looked over to him, leaned close, and yelled in his ear, "At this speed, their gas can't last long. They'll have to stop soon." And thankfully, we did. As we rolled up to the pumps, they hit us up for gas money. I think picking up hitchhikers were how they were financing their trip. The new guy was incredulous and told them off. And they weren't going to get any of my money. So we left them, panhandling for coins, at a truck stop still 100 miles from Kansas City. And as we got out of the car, it started to sleet. We took cover under a overpass nearby, and we were huddled there under that bridge, trying to stay warm when we saw that brown Pontiac station wagon roar out of sight. He turned to me. "You know what really pisses me off? I get treated like crap all the time because I'm homeless. And those people, they're legitimate because they have a car and probably a house. They're crazy, dangerous people. I'm a nice guy. I'm just unlucky." And he proceeded to tell me the story of the failed meatpacking plant and losing his girlfriend, his car, and his house. I looked him over. We were of similar ages, wore similar clothes, and carried similar backpacks. Neither of us had a car, a job, or a girlfriend. But while I was on the road to have a good time, he was a latter-day hobo. Now, he may not have had my life advantages, but at that moment in time, the only difference that I could see between him and I was that after life had knocked me around a bit, I had a place to land, a room, meals, a safety net. It seemed a very thin line between us. Now, you would think in a world where the homeless are all around us, that this experience would be with me often. But the fact is, I have forgotten it again and again. When I see a homeless person, I reflexively think that cannot happen to me. And I have all the reasons why. But eventually, that memory returns of that rattling brown Pontiac station wagon with the fake wood siding. And I remember just how much alike I was to that homeless guy under the bridge. Thank you.
This is KTOO News Juneau 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on February 12, 2014. The theme for the evening was On the Road. Visit mudrooms.org to tell your story. Audio production by Clint Farr.